Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us tonight. We are going to spend the first part of our program talking about President Barack Obama and his administration. There's been a lot of critique by even the head of the Black Congressional Caucus that President Barack Obama has not appointed any African Americans to his cabinet, and that, as we pointed out in another conversation, that his entire inner circle at the White House is made up of mostly white men. Is that significant or is it not significant? Are there things more significant than that? We're going to wrestle with that, and we're going to talk about other issues that coming up around the White House, whether it's including are banks really too big to prosecute, issues around that, and issues around Homeland Security and drones. So we're going to talk all about that in the first part of our program. We are joined here, once again, Kelly Goff is with us. She's correspondent for The Root, regular and a regular contributor to The Huffington Post, author of the books Party Crashing, How the Hip-Hop Generation Declared Political Independence, and The GQ Candidate. And Kelly, always great to have you back with us. Welcome.
It's great to be back.
And in the studio, Dr. Jack Fruchtman is professor of political science at Towson University. Jack, good to have you back. It's been a few years.
Pleasure.
Good to have you on the show with us again. And it's only been a few months. For Dr. Jared Ball, associate professor in the Department of Communications here at Morgan State University, can be found online at imix what I like.
Right? I mix what I like.
Did I say imix?
Well, I mean the way it looks on paper. You know,
I mix what I like. .org. Author of I Mix What I Like, a mixtape manifesto. Good to have you here, Jared.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
410-319-8888. Leave it to an old man to
There's a lot going on, man.
There's a lot going on. So let's talk about this issue, and I'll let you start, Kelly. There's been a lot made of this. Dwayne Wickham, who heads communications department here and is a columnist for the USA Today, pushed this on his Facebook and in his columns. The head of the Congressional Black Caucus stood up and said something. I was waiting for one of the African-American congressional leaders to stand up and say something, if they say anything. What's the significance, insignificance, symbolism, depth to all this? Kelly?
Well, there is huge significance. And for the record, a very high-profile African-American congressional voice has spoken about this.
Right.
Congressman Rangel said on MSNBC that it's embarrassing as hell.
Right.
And I think that pretty much says it all. It is embarrassing to have an African-American president, and yet you can actually cite a Republican white president who preceded him who actually had a more diverse cabinet than he does at the moment. And I'm talking, of course, to referring to President George W. Bush, who had Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who had Colin Powell, who had Ron, I'm completely blanking, and this is very bad, Rod Page, because I'm from Houston, so that's why I said I'm going to get in trouble for pausing on that one. It is a problem, and it's not a problem just for aesthetics. You know, I think a lot of people get bogged down in, you know, sort of what the picture looks like, the cabinet-level photos or the photos of someone's advisors, and it's really about more than that. And I want to say for the record, I think the president has gone on the record acknowledging that who you appoint to certain roles and who you hire matters more than that. And I will give you an example. He has said that very clearly on the record when we were all giving Governor Romney a tough time for his binders full of women comments, right? Let's not all forget that all of us were giving the governor a tough time and the president himself and his campaign staff because it's about, oh, if you need a binder to find a bunch of women, then that means you're not surrounding yourself with diversity. And it's like, yeah, Mr. President, that's true. That's an interesting point you raise. But the other time that the president's really gone on the record addressing this issue is something I've written about previously when I wrote about his Supreme Court nominations. And there is a video from years ago when the president was first running for president the first time around, and he talked about how at the end of the day, most of the cases that are decided in our country are pretty clear-cut by the law. It's usually about, 5 to 10% of cases that end up making it to the Supreme Court and are really issues for debate. They're not clear-cut. It's not clearly laid out in the Constitution and the federal law that we have before us. And he says that at that point, you're really not talking about someone's legal mind. You're talking about their life experiences. You're talking about not what's in their head, but what's in their heart. And him being the president, who's very eloquent, he actually said it much more eloquent than I just did. But my point is, he acknowledges that life experience and where you're coming from and what you're bringing to the table has a huge impact on what shapes our public policy and what shapes our laws. That's why this issue really matters, and that's why a lot of us are frustrated, disappointed, and disturbed that there is such a lack of diversity so far, not just in his cabinet, but at the senior advisor level, I mean, besides Valerie Jarrett.
Jared?
Well, I mean, personally, I'm glad that he hasn't put more black and brown faces in to be part of this administration. I'm more embarrassed to be associated with the policies coming out of his White House than the absence of so-called people of color. So I'm always an advocate more that we need political diversity more than gender or racial or even sexuality diversity. And we don't get any of that. We never get that. So I don't want to have any more black and brown people associated with the policies coming out of the White House. I'm more embarrassed by Obama, even though I never voted for him and never supported him, only because much of the world now puts black people in lockstep with these policies, where historically we were always given credit in the world for not having anything to do with what America's imperialism was doing. And I think Obama is intelligent. Obama's no dummy. And the more I go back and actually, you know, take the advice of friends and colleagues and read his books, I mean, I'm clear that he is, I'm more clear at least, that he is very clear what he's doing. He knows how race is played in this country. He knows exactly what he's doing. So he knows when he can play the diversity piece and put some people of color here and there. And he knows, or those who handle him know, when that's not acceptable. And when it comes down to serious everyday business, we need white men running the show. And I think Obama knows that and has been playing us on this point from the beginning. And as he keeps telling us, he's not the president of black people. He doesn't care anything in particular about black and brown people, and certainly not in terms of any policy decisions. So why should it be any different? So I wouldn't want credit for what he's about to do in the second term. I wouldn't want to be associated with it since, with some sort of false inclusiveness. And so I'm glad. I'm glad. I hope he continues this trend.
Go ahead, Kelly. I want to turn to Jack.
I just have a slightly different take, and that is this. Obama really has nothing to worry about. This is his last run for office in 2012. He's not going to run for office any further. I can't imagine he's going to go back to the Senate after being in the White House, although it has happened in the past. John Quincy Adams became a member of the House after he was president, but he was defeated. He never served more than one term. But I don't think he has anything to lose. He can do just about anything he wants. And I think in terms of these kinds of appointments. On the other hand, I would say this. From my point of view, I would say that competence is more important than race or religion or creed or national origin. And I think what we need to look at is whether or not these people are in fact competent. I was shocked, and I still am shocked. And forget all the stuff that came out during the hearings. That Chuck Hagel was nominated to be Secretary of Defense. I don't understand that nomination at all. And again, I'm not talking about what he said about gays. I'm not saying what he said about the Israeli lobby or anything else. I'm just saying I don't understand why he's Secretary of Defense. Third, we do have Eric Holder. He's a holdover from the first administration. He's an African American. Susan Rice was supposed to be, as everybody said, Secretary of State. They hung her out to dry on this Benghazi thing. They gave her the wrong talking points, and she was basically left to swing and hang and twist in the wind, and nobody came to her rescue after that. That would have been a woman, minority, I suppose you could say, if women are minorities, I guess they're not, and an African American. So on those points, I think that I would agree with Jared on this. Why be associated with any of it anyway?
Kelly, go ahead.
Can I jump in here, though? I think these are interesting arguments to me, and I have a problem with a little bit of the tone that this conversation's taking, because whenever someone tends to raise that I'm more concerned about competence than color and gender, that usually to me, I'm not saying it is for him, but it often reads as an excuse, as if the things aren't mutually exclusive.
Let me
let her finish her statement.
But I did mention Hagel.
Right. Well, you did mention Hagel.
Who's a white guy.
You did, and he is definitely a white guy, but I think it also segues into one of the points that I've certainly written about with the president, which is Hagel, he really went to the mat for Susan Rice, he didn't.
Yes.
And I think that doesn't sit well with a lot of people, particularly when you make a very valid point that there are plenty of unqualified or incompetent white Americans. There are very the white Americans competing for these roles, and yet there's sort of this woe is me, you know, we're having trouble finding more qualified, diverse people. Give us more time. And yet Susan Rice, no one went to the mat for, although her name is now being floated, as I've written, for the National Security Advisor role. The other thing I want to pipe in here and say is that this conversation really did segue into talking about race. One of the things I've written quite a bit about is gender diversity. And I really have a problem with this idea that, like, that's great for progressives who are unhappy with policy. I think that one way that you end up with policies you're happier with is when you have more diversity of thought and diversity of opinion in the room, and I don't believe you end up with that all the time when everyone looks exactly alike. I think that is actually part of the problem. But in terms of me as an African-American woman, this is not just a race conversation for me. This really is a gender diversity issue as well, and I will give you a perfect example of why. I've been writing about the contraception issue for years. It happened to become sort of the hot political issue when everyone was up for re-election, and, you know, we had the issue with the church filing lawsuits about the healthcare debate. This has been an issue for years, the problems about coverage. And so the reason that there wasn't really a lot of talk about it, and the reason that the White House was late to really come to the table and really addressing it, as I was complaining about for quite some time, I think is what happens when you have a bunch of men in a room who aren't actually worried about things like going to the pharmacist and having your pharmacist tell you that it's not covered, which is something myself and a number of women had dealt with before, even with switching insurance that you're paying hundreds of dollars a month for. So those are the types of things that end up when you have a lack of diversity. I'm not just talking about drone programs. There are a lot of issues where it matters, and so this is one of the things I'm concerned about.
But again, I mean, but appointing a woman, Susan Rice is no different from a white male in terms of her positions regarding the White House policies or anything like that. So my point would be the same. Hold on, excuse me. So my point would be the same. I don't know. But my point would be that the same for gender as it would be for race, that we need to look past that and look more closely at what the policies of these people are so that we don't just get played on all of this.
I think it's a combination. Because let me say this. I'm sorry. I have to make this point. For instance, it was Condoleezza Rice and General Powell both broke with the Bush administration on affirmative action. And even though the Bush administration ended up being wrong by filing that brief, having those voices at the table, I'll give you this example. When George W. Bush was leaving the White House, he finally admitted that legacy admissions were unfair. Now, do you think that's a conclusion he would have come to?
No, I just think that pales in comparison to having Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice support the imperial strategies of the foreign.
I
don't see how they equate.
Let me ask this question: Is there something here though that both are? Both are relevant in different ways. I mean, it's relevant over who you pick ideologically and what they uphold and what they stand for. But you don't expect President Barack Obama to pick somebody who's not in his ideological world
He wouldn't.
Correct? No, most people wouldn't.
Of course.
Right?
He's living proof that complexion and apparent heritage have nothing to do with your politics.
On the other hand...
I think that's very naive.
Well, wait, let me finish. But on the other hand, does the race is important, as is gender, in who you pick, if for nothing more than the perception of people in this country to see who is intelligent, who is in charge, who can accomplish things. And that also accounts for something. I mean, to have a African-American, whether you agree with politics or not, or her politics, Secretary of State, Defense, Treasury,
with all of that because all of the women that I encourage my daughters, for instance, to know of, would not want them to be associated with the policies that these people are involved in. So I don't need Condoleezza Rice or I don't need any Obama to give inspiration to my black and brown daughters. I have many other examples that I would point them to, and I think, in fact, for those of us who claim to be progressive or radical or even revolutionary, when we have these people put up in front of us, and that what all it does is encourages more of our own people to associate themselves with the state and with this definition of what is acceptable or what is successful or what is intelligent. So I don't think Condoleezza Rice or Susan Rice are politically intelligent. I don't think
Kelly.
I'm going to say I commend him for having the luxury of living in a world where most of the power structure looks like him. And, you know, he doesn't have to worry about the idea. I mean, I would think he would, having daughters, of the idea of actually seeing representations of female power, even if he doesn't agree with them on every issue.
No, they see them all the time.
It's like listening to a white male say,
yeah,
you know,
Asada Shakur.
I'd rather have my daughter see someone who agrees with me than actually see other women out there. It matters. The representation actually does matter. Actually seeing women in those positions matters. And so this idea that, so I'll give you a very quick anecdote that Madeleine Albright told when she said years ago when her granddaughter was
Madeleine Albright, that's my point.
Secretary of State of Clinton, you know, got it. And she said, oh, her daughter, who was her granddaughter, said, well, why is it a big deal? Women are always seeing that. Those kinds of images matter.
And then she said it was great that they killed 500,000 Iraqi children due to sanctions. She said that she supported the killing of Iraqi children.
No, you can't hear each other when we do this.
We're having two separate conversations. I am sorry that you don't live in a country where every person agrees with you. That's not how democracy works. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but that's not how democracy works. And there are plenty of people I don't agree with on every single issue. It doesn't mean that they don't have a right to serve in the role and have their voice heard, even if I expect the person above them to ultimately countermand them. Even if I ultimately expect the person who brings them in to listen to their counsel, have vigorous debate with them, and ultimately countermand them. But having this dismissive attitude that it just absolutely doesn't matter, I'd rather have an all.
No, in fact, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I'm saying quite the opposite. I'm not dismissing it at all. Hold on. See, this is my point. I'm not dismissing it at all. What I'm doing is analyzing it from the perspective of those in power who know very well the impact that these window dressing appointments have on well-meaning people, and this is precisely the point. So it's not that I'm deluded or confused about the world I live in. That's precisely my point. My point is I don't want them. This is the point. Let me just say it this way. Let me just make this point very quickly.
That assume, Jared.
Hold on. Real quick. I went back recently and heard a wonderful the wonderful debate years ago that was held between William Styron and Ossie Davis, and Ossie Davis said. The main reason why black people have rejected Uncle Tom, despite being given to us by Harry Beecher Stowe.
Oh, he wrote Uncle Tom's cabin book.
William Styron wrote a book about Nat Turner.
About Nat Turner, I mean.
But he was saying the reason we don't like your Nat Turner, William Styron, and the reason we don't like Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom, and the reason why to this day so many black people reject Uncle Tom as a concept without recognizing that he was more or less made to be a hero in her book and that she was not a racist. His point was because you have given them to us. They don't come out of our own struggle and our own experience. So my point is that when I want to inspire my daughters or my students or my colleagues, I don't point to those who have been sanctioned by our political enemies. That is the point. And they know very well that by putting these people in front of us, that it will cause this kind of confusion. That is exactly my point. So I do show my daughters women and powerful women in the context that I want them to understand power. So Asada Shakur.
I appreciate you worrying about women's confusion for us. That's really helpful to have.
Well, I mean, I have to, and to a certain extent, that I'm raising two daughters.
Wait, we have to do this one at a time because people on radio cannot hear 10 people talking.
Because we need a man to tell us who to look up to.
That is an absurd distortion of what I said. That is an absurd distortion of what I just said.
We need to move on to some other subjects here, and Kelly, you're welcome to stay. Umar Farouk has joined us, but let me just throw this out there. One of the things I think that's coming up here is this is the complexity, because you could argue your points, Jared, not saying I disagree or agree, but you can argue your points on either side of the equation here, because that's the complexity of race in politics in America. You indicated in what you were saying the complexities of it.
I'm not absolutely.
So I'm saying? I mean, so it's like it's the there's power in seeing power in faces of color in power, whether you agree with that power or not. It can also be a trick bag, but on the other hand, I mean, if you look at it when Republicans or conservatives put a person of color in power, it's usually saying, oh, look, we have black people too.
But Democrats do the same thing.
Although commonly not the same way. It's a difference. Genuine influence, you just didn't agree with her policies and neither did I. I think that's a little disingenuous to be like Condoleezza Rice did nothing. She did a lot of things people don't agree with. And that's one thing to say, that I just don't agree with her policies, but to make it sound like she's window dressing, she was completely unqualified.
I didn't say she was unqualified.
We should never have more black people, because I think this whole argument is really kind of...
No, her talent and her brilliance made her qualified to do for them what she was intended to do. So that's exactly my point. I didn't say she was unqualified.
No, but are we also equating? Let me bring Umar Farouk in, who's been waiting to jump in this conversation as well. Journalist for the Baltimore Independent, Reader, The Nation, Salon.com, and ForeignPolicy.com out of Washington. Umar, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, how are you?
you sure about that? So
I can't hear him.
Wait, he just spoke very softly, but he'll be joined back in. Are we equating very quickly? So I want to move on to the subject around the Obama administration here. So are we equating saying if you are a person of color in America, that means you have to be a radical, you have to be left, you have to be a revolutionary?
That's ridiculous.
Clarence Thomas.
Oh, you're asking me?
Is that by definition what we're saying?
I would hope so, given the conditions of these communities. But that's not necessarily what I'm saying. What I'm really trying to say is that to quell progressive and radical critique, those of the liberal left and the radical right do the same thing. They offer window dressing appointments to show a false inclusivity to quell the potential rebellion from communities who are continuously abused and oppressed.
So
the second half of your program today belies much of my detractors' argument.
That does happen. He's right that does happen, but that's not the conversation that I was invited to have tonight. And that's why I'm perplexed, because Condoleezza Rice wasn't window dressing. You just didn't agree with her policies, neither did I. And that doesn't change the overall point that having diversity of thought as well as diversity in gender and race is also an important part of this dichotomy. And that's what I'm saying, is it sounds like we're having a, it's either one or the other, and I don't believe that. I actually think it's all of the above. I think it's important, all of the above. And so I find it, you know, this a little reminds me of, if I don't like the game, I'm taking my ball home, and that is not how we change things. I mean, God forbid we had done that and there had actually been no women, because they all said, I'm so unhappy with what Obama's done so far, I'm just going to leave the White House. Then you know what? My contraception would have been cut. He would have stopped fighting, because he was close to stopping fighting, and the only reason he didn't is because the women in the White House wouldn't let him. And that's what I'm talking about here.
So let me do this. And the reason that both Kelly, you and Jared are here, as well as Jack, we had them for a minute, is because I knew you two would have very different opinions. We need to put those on the table for people to wrestle with out in the world. And you both very ably kind of did that, as Jack did as well. But we want to kind of move on to some other issues around the administration. And I know, Kelly, you weren't sure that you want to stay for that part of the conversation, or could.
I actually can't stay for that part of the conversation, but I have really enjoyed this one, and I'm sure this one will be, the next part will be just as spicy.
You're wonderful, Kelly Goff. Thank you for being with us once again.
Always love doing the show. Thank you. Bye.
You can meet her in The Root, and we'll connect to all of her work on SantaShow.org. So, and Umar Farouk, and you're on the panel with us now. And what I want to do here, as soon as we come back from break, is to jump into the other aspects of what's happening in the Obama administration, from saying banks are too big to prosecute, and the whole question around Homeland Security, drones, and how that fits into policy. And I will throw out a thesis that we talked about in yesterday's production meeting to see if it is off the wall or straight ahead. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to this conversation, let me very quickly tell you that I think I'm going to tell you now so I can find out where this is on the sheet, since we don't have it here yet. Okay, I'll do that on the next break. All right, so let me jump in here and introduce our guest once more. Umar Farouk just joined us, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who's written for the Baltimore Independent Reader, The Nation, Salon.com, ForeignPolicy.com, Dr. Jared Ball, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication Studies here at Morgan State University, and can be found online at imixwhatilike.org, and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, Dr. Jack Fruchtman, frequent contributor on op-ed pages, professor in the Department of Political Science at Towson University, 410-319-8888. I give out the number. We never did get the phones in the first half an hour. We'll try to in this half an hour. But, Umar, let me start with you. And welcome to the program once again.
How are you?
I'm very well. Good to have you with us. We were looking at this issues around the drones, and I think there's been some confusion. I don't think the administration said it would kill people in America with drones, but that still is it becomes an issue around Homeland Security. The article in Forbes magazine that talks about $1.6 billion rounds of ammunition that Homeland Security has. Seven people prosecuted under acts similar to what happened to Daniel Ellsberg, but more than any other president in the history of the United States. What's your analysis of what we're seeing?
I think as far as the 1.6 billion rounds of ammo for Homeland Security, I think it's not super surprising, just because we know that the sort of the national security industry has really ballooned in the last decade. We've known for a while now that there's been almost a trillion people in the U.S. that have civilians that have top secret security clearances. We've spent about $1 trillion on the homeland security industry in the last decade in America. So it's not that surprising that, you know, there's so much being spent for even, you know, for future possible operations, whatever they might be, whatever the administration might have in mind.
We were warned about the dangers of the military-industrial complex by President Eisenhower, who I would like to remind everybody was a conservative Republican. And it's come to pass in this century more than any time in our history. And I would say even more so under President Obama. President Obama, I think, really does see the difference between campaigning and governing. He's been accused of being only in campaign mode over the past several weeks since he was reelected. But he understands what governing is. But his way of governing is, one, to have more drone strikes abroad than the George W. Bush administration ever had, and maybe that's because the drones are better and more accurate, although they seem to take out a whole lot of civilians in addition to the so-called targets that we have. We've arrested more people and sent them back, illegal immigrants, than under George W. Bush. We've arrested leakers more than anybody. What's interesting is that they keep using a piece of legislation that has been on the books since 1917, the Espionage Act of 1917, to go after our own people. This is typically in the past, it's to go after spies, it's to go after people who are working on behalf of foreign governments. But we actually go after our own people who leak information, and they actually think they're doing something good when they leak the information. It's going to be used, for example, against Bradley Manning. And I'm not saying what he did was good or bad. All I'm saying is that they're going to use it. And he could probably go to jail for the rest of his life for leaking hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks a couple of years ago.
And as was pointed out, the documents he did leak, there's been a seventh man now indicted, not on that, but on similar kind of issues, is that he was very careful not to leak security secrets mm-hmm. and things he had access to. He leaked what was declassified, but not shown to the public, which I think is an important distinction in terms of what he did. Jared.
And I also think it's important to add, you know, what's coming out of this case, too, that in the Obama administration's desire to punish whistleblowers using this Espionage Act, as was just said, is the attack on media, that if you report, at least if we're to follow the logic that's being used in the Bradley Manning case, that if WikiLeaks takes this document and publishes it, that they too can be charged with releasing secrets and helping the enemy and so on and so forth, which would then mean the New York Times, the Washington Post, and every major newspaper in the world would be targeted under this as well. So this is stamping out dissent. It's stamping out critical inquiry. It's stamping out what is supposed to be the watchdog role of the press. All happening, as Glenn Ford at Black Agenda Report says, under a president who is not the lesser of two evils, but the more effective evil. And this is what I think is what we have to deal with, that because of his blackness, because of his brilliance, because of, as you were saying off air, the beauty of his family, and the hope that many people around the world attach to his presidency, he's getting away with things that nobody else can get away with. Even Foreign Affairs magazine was talking about when he gave his speech in Africa, condemning African leadership for all the problems of the African continent. Was it Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy? One of those major was saying that no white president could do that. I mean, it was even discussed openly in the white elite press that no white president could get away with this kind of stuff. And I think that carries over into all of these other things, that he's using this goodwill that so many in the world had for him or those who are running him are using it to push through some of the most draconian things that we've seen. And it's only going to get worse.
I don't want to get a digression here too deep, but just very quick question, quick response.
Sure.
That's what you just said, Jared. Do you really believe in that people are running him? I don't have a difficult time with what people represent and what interests they represent, but the fact that we are thinking people are actually running him?
Well, I mean, I don't mean to say that he's not intelligent, but this is what politics are. This is what politicians are. Every president, every politician, and every campaign, every level Even when I was running for the Green Party, I mean, you are always representing a constituency. You are always representing policies and ideas that of your party, of your leadership. So it's not it isn't that it's just coming from Obama by himself. He is being impacted as any other president would have been or would be.
Yeah, Jack.
A quick comment. You talk about the Green Party. He was an awfully green president. It's 2 years in the Senate, United States Senate. Before that, in the state senate in Illinois, he is intelligent. He's smart. He knows a lot of things. But there's a certain thing about being in politics for a relatively long time where you begin to run the show. And I'm not sure. I don't have evidence that he's not, but I don't have evidence that he is. And I think that's part of the problem.
Folks, let's go to the phones here, then we'll go right back to Umar Farooq for the next comment. 410-319-8888. Leo, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Mark Steiner.
Yes, Leo, welcome.
How you doing?
Very well.
And your guests. It's an honor to join this post-racial conversation. I'm one of the so-called people of color, but I consider myself a black African-American. Let me just say this. Elijah Cummings is a guy, and Clarence Thomas are people, examples of people who are not going to enter into this conversation. The President of the United States has always walked on eggshells regarding matters of race. He never wanted to appear to be too black. His wife is to the left of him, in my opinion. Michelle Obama, I think of her as a black woman. I think of him as a guy who is pointedly focused on the fact that he had a black father and a white mother, and sometimes the white predominates, and too often the white predominates. The president would never appoint a black person to serve in any capacity unless he believed that person was competent. But I must tell you that this president bears watching, but what choice did we have in the past election? He was certainly better than his opposition, his competition, but by the same token, he's only going to continue to pander to institutional racism as it currently exists in this country, and that's all he can do. His hands are tied. I agree with your guess that, although he may be running this to some extent, he's got to pander to those forces. He's pandering to Israel on this question of Iran. There's no question about that. And of course, we've got people like the mayor of our city is very much like Obama. You know, they're black on the outside, but they're white on the inside.
Let me grapple with this, because we have like 6 minutes or 7 minutes before we jump into the Chavez conversation. Umar, you want to jump in that first, and then our other guests in the studio can jump in?
Yeah, I think it's true for almost anyone or any position, sort of in any position of authority, or even anyone who's a professor or in academia. You're sort of shaped as you go through life by different experiences, and part of the experience is how you were raised in your family, and part of it is the institutions that you go through. So I think there's a lot of things where President Obama obviously is more shaped by institutions where he studied or the colleagues that he worked with. And then there's probably other things where, you know, the fact that he is black are going to come out. Like after the Trayvon Martin shooting, he went in front of the press and he said, "If I had a son, he would look like Trayvon." You know, no one else could have said that at that point. And regardless of what you think about Obama in terms of his foreign policy, at that point he did speak up and sort of represent the black America that needed to be represented at that moment. Later on, you can say that maybe he didn't sort of go after, you know, the gun lobby or go after these, you know, pro-gun people as much as he could have. So there's going to be certain points where, you know, people can sort of stick up and sort of say, you know, I represent this particular constituency and here's a point. But obviously on the foreign policy issue, President Obama is more shaped by the institutions that he's gone through and the people that he works with. Because there aren't many other voices in those institutions, it's just the fact that those are the kinds of policies that are going to come out. Suzanne Rice wasn't dismissed by the Republicans because she was black or she was a woman. She was dismissed because they wanted to go after someone about the Benghazi attacks. They're they're just really, really crazy about the Benghazi attack, and she happened to be the easiest person to sort of go after. Condoleezza Rice might be a great person, but the people that she worked with when she was Secretary of State happened to have that particular kind of right-wing thinking, and, you know, so when it comes to foreign policy, you have to judge those people on what they actually did when they were put in that situation.
Jack, we have about 3 minutes left in this segment.
I would agree that you are shaped by your background in the institutions from which you came. And if you look at Obama's institutions, Harvard Law School and the University of Chicago, where he taught, these are elite places. And I would say that that's probably part of the problem. But that's not going to change. We have to remember that there's only, well, less than 4 years now left of his administration. And then after that, who knows?
He cherry picks when to be black. And it was very easy for him to make the Trayvon Martin comment but he didn't say anything about Troy Davis. He didn't stop that execution or other executions like it. But more importantly, as Baldwin pointed out years ago, it's the institutions that have to be judged, not the individuals. So whenever he feels like he's black and can associate with the black community, that's all fine and good. But he, whether it's because of his own desire or because he is being handled, the output of the institution he runs can't and is not helping black people or anybody else for that matter. So that's what I think is the most important point here.
Well, I think that, I mean, there's a, again, I think it'd be important to maybe next time convene a longer discussion just about the complexities of race and politics and what this administration means. Because, I mean, there are a lot of points here. When Leo, who I've known since we were both civil rights workers back in the early 60s, who called in, says somebody is black on the outside, white on the inside, what does that mean in the 21st century? I mean, how do we define that? It's not that there's that rhetorical kind of flourish, but what does that mean? Mm-hmm. How does that play into questions of class and race in America and the complexities that exist within that? I mean, so that I think these are complex questions that sometimes our rhetorical flourishes too easily kind of, wave over them without kind of. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. And Umar, I'm sorry we didn't get more into it. We got kind of hung up in the last segment a little bit, but it's always great to have you on, Umar Farooq, and I appreciate you taking the time. I hope you'll join us again. Umar, still there?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Always good to have you with us. And Jared,
yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Always great to have you. Jared, thank you for coming to the studio.
Anytime. Always a pleasure.
We'll talk. We know we're going to plan a show for May 19th on Malcolm X's birthday, but hope Jared will come in again before that.
Anytime.
And Jack Fruchtman, now that we got you back in the Mark Steiner show, it's been a few years. Let's not be a stranger and have you back.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Maybe have you on to debate your old buddy Vats right here in the studio.
Oh, that'd be fun.
So we'll do all that. We're going to take a 30-second break here and come right back and be joined by George Chicorio Mar and Margarita Lopez Maya to discuss and debate the death of Chavez and what it means and what Chavez's administration has meant. Stay with us.